Howdy. This is Dr. John here with you for another Thursday afternoon Q&A session. And I got to tell you, I'm very, very excited, like jumping up and down excited, right? We've gotten some great questions. When I was doing this last year, we weren't getting all that many questions. And now I won't even be able to get to all of them today. I'm going to probably get through three of them, and I've got another bunch that I'll get to next week. So if I don't get to your question this week, I'll probably get to it next week. But keep sending them in. Y'all are sending some very, very good questions. And in fact, many of them I love to spend a day talking about. Won't spend quite that much time, but we will do a couple today and see where we end up here. So I'm going to have Catherine just, you know, we've got a whole file full of questions. I'm going to have her read some to me, and we'll just kind of go with them.
Okay, first question. Have you heard of transient global amnesia as an adverse effect following COVID or COVID jabs or postmenopausal women?
The answer is yes. I've seen a fair amount. I don't see tons of it. A few patients a year, but I've seen more lately. And it's very difficult in many cases to place attribution, like what caused what. We know that there are significantly higher risk factors for many conditions post-COVID. We know that there are significantly higher risks in many people post-COVID vaccination. So we can see those numbers, but even then it doesn't prove definitively that that's causation. Now, sometimes it looks pretty suspicious. It's a pretty smoking gun out there. But anyway, I have seen more lately. In transient global amnesia, transient meaning it's not there, then it comes, and then it goes. Global means really all around everything. There's amnesia affecting everything. And then amnesia, of course, the loss of memory and in some levels of some cognition. Age, and so you asked about, I think, postmenopausal, was that?
Postmenopausal. Yeah.
And so age is significantly associated with transglobal amnesia. Diabetes, patients with diabetes also have significantly higher rates of transglobal amnesia. And unfortunately, and this doesn't get talked about much, I mean, when someone has transglobal amnesia, generally the doctor will say, oh, don't worry about it, not a big deal. But actually, it is a significant issue because there is an increased long-term risk of dementia in patients that experience transient global amnesia. So it is a concern. And I personally think it's enough concern to do a little more research into it. Now, diabetes alone, often people call dementia type 3 diabetes because high blood sugars will certainly kick up the likelihood. As with aging, there's more diabetes, there's more dementia, et cetera. So it stands to reason that the transient global amnesia cases would go up with age and with diabetes. The clearest risk factors then are age. People over 50, it goes up with age, but over 50, there's a much higher risk of transient global amnesia than there is in younger people. A history of migraines. In fact, that's probably the number one area of research. Migraines generally are a problem with blood circulation in the head and or the brain. And so if there are migraines, your risk of transient global amnesia is significantly higher than that of someone who has not experienced migraines. But it's something that if someone has transient global amnesia, I would not take it lightly and just kind of, oh, it's over now. It's transient. And I would do recommend a good workup for blood flow issues. And we do that a lot in COVID, no matter what, because in COVID and the vaccine, obviously, they both contain significant amounts of spike proteins. Contrary to what some people had said at one time, these spike proteins go everywhere in your body. Do they not stay local? It's very clear that they can travel, and they can then clog up any organ or blood vessel in which they accumulate. Okay, so this is well known. Blood flow problems we encounter very frequently. Most of my long COVID patients that we see, and I see quite a few, have blood flow issues. The first thing I do is treat them for blood stasis in Chinese medicine and or micro clotting from a Western medical perspective. And in micro clots, there are just many, many tiny, tiny blood clots that can't really be seen with imaging because they're too small. There are chemical tests that can be done, which we do a lot of, to determine how significant the blood clotting is. Now, in New Zealand, South Africa, and a few other countries, if a patient comes to the hospital and is admitted, and sometimes even when they're not admitted, but they just come to the hospital, they are given a triple oral anticoagulant therapy. Okay, so those are blood thinners, typically, is how we what we talk about and think about them. And they're given three different types. Not coincidentally, I'm sure, the readmission rate is a fraction of what it is in the United States and in countries that don't do that. And so it should be just treating, avoiding long COVID 101. Now, in our clinic, we also do a triple anticoagulant anticoagulant treatment, but we're using things that are milder, safer. We're using things like proteolytic enzymes, natokinase, serrapeptase, lumbrokinase, and then herbs like danshan, salvia root, which really explodes microclots, and then a variety of other blood-moving herbs. And again, we do that routinely. Now, in traditional Chinese medicine, blood stasis, blood stagnation, where the blood is not moving what we would consider optimally, is the proximate cause of most death, right? So when people die, the number one thing they actually die of is blood stasis. For example, diabetes. High blood sugars don't kill people. They're not the proximate cause, the immediate cause. Now, they cause damage. They cause the blood to get hypercoagulable, so it sticks to itself. They damages then the blood vessels, et cetera. But what kills people are the blood clots and the lack of blood flow in the heart, the lack of blood flow to the small vessels in the feet and the legs, and the lack of blood flow through the small vessels in the kidneys. That's what actually causes the deaths. Now, certainly the diabetes is important. It's leading to it. But the smoking gun that actually fires that last shot is blood stasis. And I'm seeing a lot of, well, not a lot, but I'm seeing a significant number of talking heads, the people that do the webinars and do a lot of the writing in the West, are now pointing at sticky blood, which is blood stasis. Sticky blood, and seeing the same problems that we see in traditional Chinese medicine. So fortunately, people are really starting to acknowledge what a significant, significant problem that is. Now, in Chinese medicine, we're looking at the sublingual veins under the tongue. We're feeling the pulse. We look at a few things in terms of coloration in the face, et cetera. And also some changes in the fingernails to determine if there's blood stasis. In the West, and we do this to prove it from a Western standpoint, we do a test called a fibrinogen test. Fibrinogen is really measuring the clot-forming capacity. Now, that's not quite right, but it's close enough. And so fibrin is the chemical that is released from fibrinogen that causes clots to form, you know, so you don't bleed out, et cetera. However, in the case of post-COVID, you don't want those blood clots. Second test is a D-dimer, the letter D-dimer. And D-dimer is to measure for clot breakup activity. So fibrinogen is the possibility. D-dimer is the actuality and the breakdown. And in the West, they use D-dimer as a test for deep vein thrombosis. But it also works for microclotting or for superficial vein thrombosis. Unfortunately, it's grossly underutilized in the U.S. In China, it's used on basically every patient that goes to the hospital. They do a D-dimer. Another test that is underutilized is a high sensitivity C-reactive protein. Now, C-reactive proteins are produced when there's inflammation. High sensitivity is often called cardiac C-reactive protein, and that's really inflammation in the heart and the arteries around the heart. So we test high sensitivity CRP. Again, we're looking for blood clotting, but in this case, it could also help detect myocarditis or infections or inflammation. And there are many more we recommend. If, you know, if we think the heart muscle is damaged, we'd order a troponin test. So there are tons and tons of different tests. But fibrinogen, D-dimer, and HS-CRP would really be a minimum. And those are not horrifically expensive tests. Everything we would run total, I mean, way more than the ones I just mentioned, are well under $100. So it's not like it's going to really break the bank. So now, if you have someone in your life, you, friend, relative, et cetera, and they've had any brain scans done, okay, MRI, CAT scan, et cetera, angiography, anything to look at blood flow, look for the term small vessel ischemia. So small vessel means tiny vessels in the brain. Ischemia means a lack of blood flow. Now, I would say that 90% of the time that I see that on a report that someone has received from their medical doctor, they've never been told that that was on the report, and they're always shocked, okay? Small vessel ischemia. It's a very important term, right? It means there's reduced blood flow in the brain, and you better doggone fix it as soon as you can. And so we have formulas, herbs, supplements to treat small vessel ischemia or blood flow in the brain. Now, a semi-related relationship is the use of statin drugs. Now, that's not going to be the issue here, actually, because statins actually cause global amnesia of a permanent or at least longer nature. And it would come on slowly. It wouldn't be like transient global where it's like 1 minute you're fine, the next minute you don't know, you can't tell what's going on, and then after a few hours, you're okay again. Here in longer-term global amnesia, you can lose memory permanently. There's a book called The Thief of Memory, by a Dr. Duane Graveline. Yeah, Duane Graveline. And Dr. Graveline was an astronaut and a NASA flight surgeon. You don't become an astronaut or a NASA flight surgeon without being really, really bright. So Dr. Graveline was put on some of the earlier statin drugs. And fortunately, one of his good friends, who he talked to regularly, noticed that Dr. Graveline was completely losing his mind. He was developing global amnesia. He was forgetting everything. And so he got him off this statin. And fortunately, Graveline got his memory back. If that goes on too long, some people, according to Graveline, don't get their memory back. And that brings up a question about two different forms of statin drugs. One is called hydrophilic, and the other is called lipophilic. And so cholesterol is critical for dozens, hundreds of functions in the body. It is largely represented in the cell walls of every cell in your body. It is helps form the myelin sheaths around the nerves in the brain so that they don't crosswire. It's absolutely critical. Cholesterol is a very large molecule. And so it is too large a molecule for the cholesterol that's formed in the body, in the liver, to cross the blood-brain barrier. And 25% approximately of the cholesterol resides in the brain because it's so important. And the cool thing is that because of that, the brain makes its own cholesterol. It's an absolutely magnificent system. Now, here's the thing. The lipophilic statins are very small molecular size, and they will cross the blood-brain barrier. So they can cross and go in and destroy the cholesterol in the brain. The newer hydrophilic are too large to cross the barrier, so they're better for brain health. And those are like rosuvastatin and pravastatin are the newer ones, which, by the way, seem to have better metabolic effects on bone density, definitely show better results for memory retention. And again, the memory retention stuff and dementia is all over the map. Every study shows a different result. So I take it with a grain of salt, but they do consistently show that those statins have a much higher level of preventing dementia. And the other one is muscle weakness. So I'm just throwing that in there because that can form a different type of global amnesia. So any other questions?
What are your thoughts regarding non-H. pylori ulcers?
I think they're bad. They should be punished. So Helicobacter pylori was discovered decades ago that it was the primary cause of ulcers. It's a particular type of bacteria that essentially screws itself through. So in the stomach, it's very acidic, extremely acidic. And so if you just pour acid onto the stomach tissue itself, it would eat right through it. So there's a mucus layer that lines the stomach to protect it. So the Helicopylori, unlike other bacteria, actually screw themselves through that mucus membrane and get right down into the stomach itself, the stomach tissue. And then the acid gets onto those lesions, and the combination of the bacteria and the acid will form an ulcer, or basically a hole in that tissue. And then those can obviously be fatal. That's by far the most common cause of ulcers. But other causes, NSAIDs, anti-inflammatory drugs, right? Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, all of your common over-the-counter pain relievers, those break down the stomach's defense against the acid it produces to digest food. And the stomach lining then becomes damaged, causing an ulcer to form. So it's just a different mechanism that damages that mucus membrane that's lining the stomach and allows the stomach acid to come in contact with the stomach tissue where it will burn a hole in it. There are other medications that also, particularly if taken with non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, can make that much worse or more common. Steroids do that. A lot of anticoagulants do that, low-dose aspirin, SSRIs, antidepressants, bisphosphonate drugs, so Fosamax, Actonel, can greatly increase the chance of developing ulcers. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, when I was a kid, blamed most ulcers on stress. Well, actually, we know now that most of them are caused by bacteria, but stress makes it worse. Stress alters the acid balance in the stomach and makes it easier to get ulcers. But the one that's really overlooked, and this is crazy, and it's one of the causes I would gladly stand on a soapbox for. So if someone comes into my office, and they say, oh, doc, you know, I've got stomach problems. Okay. About 50% of the time, they don't actually have direct stomach problems. They actually have gallbladder problems that are being disguised as stomach problems. And we know this because we do tons of testing. We can tell from the pulses. We can tell from palpating in their stomach, right? Where's the pain? Is it over your gallbladder? Or is it over the stomach or both? And so prolonged exposure to bile, okay? Bile is formed in the liver. It's stored in the gallbladder. It's pumped into the small intestine when you have a fatty meal or fat goes in there to help break up the fat. That's what bile does. It's like detergent. Like if you have fat on a plate and you're trying to wash it, if you put some detergent on it, just kind of explodes and it's very easy to clean. And so bile is stored in the gallbladder, released when you have a fatty meal. Now, it's released below the lower sphincter of the stomach. So it should never reflux back into the stomach. And I can't tell you how many images I've seen from endoscopies where you can actually see the bile in the stomach and there's no mention of it. Or I've also seen many times where it's you can see it and there is mention, but nobody does anything about it. Well, bile will eat a hole in your stomach just as much as acid will. So bile is not acid. It's actually alkaline, but still very, very strong. It can also then reflux up into the stomach, or I've already talked about that, but it'll reflux up into the esophagus. And so people that wake up with a bitter taste in their mouth or they have acid reflux coming up and, you know, it's got a really bad taste, it could very, very well, in fact, likely be bile reflux that is causing stomach irritation and can lead to ulcers and bleeding. And studies have shown that patients with gastric ulcers, that's ulcers in the stomach, had significantly higher concentrations of bile acids in the stomach than did normal subjects. And that was before or after a meal. They were just producing a lot more bile that was getting into the stomach. And a lot of that is stress. There's a condition in Chinese medicine. It's called an earth-wood disharmony, or liver assailing the spleen, or liver assailing the stomach. Those are all conditions that can cause bile, excess bile flow that gets refluxed up into the stomach. Often a stress-related issue. So intense anger. You know, in fact, there's the old saying, oh, the bile rose in your throat. We don't use that much anymore, but they still use it in the East. In fact, one of the greatest insults you can say about somebody is they have a tiny gallbladder. And I'm not going to go into what all that is, but it's kind of funny. So it comes up into the stomach, it burns the lining of the stomach, it burns the esophagus, and the symptoms are the same as heartburn. And a lot of people, a ton, because I see them, are told that they have GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, that is caused by acid reflux. But when they do, you know, the popular remedies for acid reflux, like acid-suppressing proton pump inhibitors or even H2 agonists, they don't help. That's because the acid reflux is at most only part of the problem. The main culprit is bile reflux, which is that backup of digestive fluid that's supposed to remain in the small intestine. Now, again, bile isn't acid, it's alkaline, but it can still burn holes in the stomach. In fact, there was an article years ago, and I don't remember for sure, I think it was in the New York Times, and it talked about how common misdiagnosis of this is. In fact, the guy that wrote it called it Shadowland. And he's talking about his wife who developed bile reflux after surgery to remove her gallbladder. And this is why one of the reasons why a lot of people still have problems after they have their gallbladder removed. And he said she'd had her gallbladder removed and she was in constant pain for 2 years. And they went to doctors all over the place and they got answers anywhere from, yeah, there's no such things as bile reflux. Really? Look at an endoscopy. Yes, there's bile reflux, but we can't do anything about it. Send them to your acupuncturist and you're going to have to learn to live with the pain. no, doc, you should have to learn to live with the pain. I'm tired of it, right? So anyway, it's a very, very common cause of stomach problems in general, and it can certainly lead to ulcers even without H. pylori. Now, also drinking alcohol in excess, particularly if it's not with food, because that can erode the mucus lining of the stomach and increases the amount of stomach acid that's produced. There's a book called Gastritis Treated by Chinese Medicine. I don't remember who wrote it. Gastritis Treated by Chinese Medicine, which goes into a lot of detail about this stuff, and it's probably worth taking a look at. Catherine, we got a couple of minutes. I could take another quickie.
All right. Who is the target audience for the liver cleanse?
This is a very long email. Very long. But the first question is, would you read it again?
Oh, who is the target audience for the cleanse?
And all I could do was smile when I heard that, because the target audience is anybody living on planet Earth today, right? Unless they have a few issues where they should not do it, such as pregnancy, right? There's too much going on here. We don't want to stir things up during pregnancy, because one of the things that the liver cleanse, flush, detox, right, will do is it will release some of these toxins back into the system so that we can get them out. But you don't want to do that while there's a fetus there, because in the cord blood of newborns, there are numerous studies, but I've never seen one that indicated fewer than an average of 180 very dangerous chemicals in the cord blood of newborns. So this is blood in the umbilical cord of infants who've never been in the world, okay? They've never been exposed to anything other than mom and mom's blood, and they're being born with 180 dangerous, many of them known cancer-causing chemicals in the cord blood. So pretty much everybody should be doing liver, gallbladder. And one of the questions I got asked, well, it's kind of confusing. You call it a cleanse, you call it a flush, you call it a detox. And the answer is yes, because it is a detox. We're breaking down products in the system, particularly in the liver and gallbladder, but in other tissues also. And then we cleanse them. Right? We are doing products that are going to get them into your intestines, and then we're flushing them. We're using binders and other products to carry those out of your system so that you don't reabsorb them. There's been over 100,000 chemicals. That's a lot. 100,000 chemicals released on society in the last 100 years that didn't exist 100 years ago, and now they're in our environment. Over 75% of them have not been tested for safety at all. And if the ones that have been tested, many of them have been found to be dangerous. So we got to figure a lot of the other 75% are dangerous also. The European Union, don't quote me on this, someone said it, I don't know if it's true, has about 3,000 chemicals on their list of dangerous chemicals. And in the US, it's something like 500. And again, don't quote me because I could be off by quite a bit, but that's 6 times more that they have on their list that are dangerous than we have here in the US. So we're looking at pesticides, we're looking at herbicides, we're looking at plastics, we're using it flame retardant chemicals. All of these are known to be cancer causing, and you need to get them out of your body if you want to be healthy. Also, heavy metals. We're full of heavy metals now. Now, when I was younger, it was lead, right? Because we had lead gas, we had lead paint. And so we were really soaked in lead, and it was really bad for children in particular, lowered their IQ. Then we got a lot of the lead out, and then it became mercury. Right? We had mercury amalgams. We had mercury in vaccines. We had mercury in fish. And so it was, mercury was the big deal. It's still a big deal, but aluminum has blown way past it. Aluminum again, aluminum cookware. And even if you don't have aluminum cookware, if you eat out, you can bet that they're using aluminum to cook in because it's the best thing to cook in, except that it kills you. But it is the best for heat transfer. So you're getting it in your food. You're getting it in your vaccines. You're getting it in numerous sources, some of them rather nefarious. And so now we're full of aluminum, mercury, and lead, and we need to get those out of our system. They are very, very implicated in dementia and a whole range of other diseases. We know that aluminum and mercury actually stop neuron growth. And the scary, scary figure, early onset Alzheimer's between the years 2013 to 2017, so that's 4 to 5 years, increased by 207%. So in that five-year period, we had a doubling of early onset Alzheimer's. And the estimates, the latest ones I've seen, they're estimating that there's about a 68% increase per year during the pandemic. I mean, this is astronomically dangerous. And that's why everybody needs to do a cleanse, flush, detox. Now, we hear about gallstones. Your homework is to go look up liver stones. I've never heard a doctor talk about liver stones. We get patients to pass them all the time, and they're really critical for your health. All right. So I've gone over the half hour. I think I'm going to stop right there.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
You're sure?
Well,
I'm not in big trouble.
No.
Okay.
Okay.
So keep sending the great questions. We've got quite a few here already, but most of them are going to be quicker for me to answer probably, but Catherine will keep throwing them at me as we do these shows. So thank you so much for tuning in. I love doing this. Please tell your friends, please tell your family. We'll be here every Thursday at 3 p.m. So until next week, be happy, be healthy.